Right now on the Daily Debrief, fallout continues from the breakdowns that led to accused pedophile Jeffrey Epstein's apparent suicide in jail. The warden may be on his way out. We'll give you an inside view of the American prison system from a former inmate and now prison consultant. And the shocking verdict in the trial of the man accused of being at the center of the kidnapping, rape, and murder of a college couple.
Did the jury reach a verdict?
Yes, we did.
Plus, another verdict in the penalty phase of the Florida man convicted of killing his parents and brother after they cut him off from a Bulgarian webcam girl.
The aggravating factors are sufficient to warrant a possible sentence of death. Yes.
Will it be life in prison or the death penalty? The Daily Debrief recaps the nation's biggest legal stories. It's Tuesday, August 13th.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Daily Debrief. I'm Jesse Weber, in for Aaron Keller. Joining me on set is special guest Julio Briones. I have a lot to break down, so let's get started. Let's start right now with the case that everybody is talking about, the apparent suicide of accused pedophile and multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein. The fallout from the lapses in procedure that allowed him to seemingly kill himself despite recently being removed from suicide watch. Here's the latest. The warden at the Manhattan Correctional Facility where Epstein was being held has been temporarily transferred, and two employees who were assigned to Epstein's unit have been placed on administrative leave. The moves were ordered by Attorney General Bill Barr as the FBI and Justice Department's Inspector General investigate. And the New York Post is reporting that the 6-foot-tall Epstein committed suicide by using a bedsheet to assemble a makeshift noose, then leaning towards the floor to strangle himself. Previous reporting has alleged that Epstein was left alone for hours before his death, even though he was supposed to have a cellmate and be checked on by guards every 30 minutes. I'm joined now by Julio Briones. He is a prison consultant and crisis manager. He was sentenced to 39 years in prison for carjacking, robbery, conspiracy, and weapons possession. But while in jail, he not only represented himself, but he has had his sentence reduced to 12 years and only served 10. Now he's the CEO of the Briones Consulting Group, and he's also the author of the book, Surviving Arrest, The Complete Guide. Julio, great to have you here. I want to get right into it. So if it's ruled that this is in fact a suicide, are you surprised that Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide? Or maybe I should say that he was allowed to be able to commit suicide?
Not in the slightest bit. Suicide is probably one of the most common situations that will happen, especially in pre-conviction. The county jail, because that's really all the MDC is, it's kind of like sitting in a regular county jail. There's such overwhelming, just the entire change of environment becomes so overwhelming that many guys end up either attempting suicide or committing suicide.
And why do you think it's so common? I mean, people think Epstein didn't think he was ever going to get out, maybe, that this is a sign of his guilt. You tell me.
Well, the reality is this. Epstein was very wealthy, and he was able to do whatever he wanted. This is a man who potentially could walk out his door, get on a plane, and go anywhere in the world, and whenever he felt like it. And all of a sudden, every breath he takes is monitored, and he's essentially locked down 20 hours a day. So You've moved him from that environment to this. Now he also called on his powerful friends and was left out in the wind because now he has to answer for everything he didn't answer before. My belief, a lot of the conspiracy stuff, it's great to listen to, but the reality is I think it overwhelmed him, and the thought of what was going to happen to him as a sex trafficker in the prison system became too much.
But somebody wants somebody to be held responsible for this. You know, if someone didn't have, there was no foul play, was there a lapse in protocol by the guards from what you've seen?
On paper, yes. In reality, having spent many years in prison, the reality is that as much as we like to think that the guards are actually up all night, let's look at this from a human perspective.
Right.
We have two guards. One of them wasn't even normally assigned as a housing guard. He was a corrections officer that was likely a case manager, covering a shift and working overtime. I'm not surprised at all. He was probably just sitting around and, you know, trying to make time pass with the other guard, or flat out sleeping.
That's the scary part. And we have about 20 seconds left. Mm-hmm. The warden being transferred, what does that tell you?
That's somebody's trying to cover their butt.
That's a scary thing to think about, given such a high-profile defendant, a high-profile case. Clearly, people want answers. They want to know what happened. And I got to tell you, I saw this article. I was shocked. I had to read it over again when I saw the breaking news over the weekend. But, Julio, we appreciate you taking the time to come here and explain all of this to us. So thanks again.
Right. Thank you again for having me.
Of course. All right, we're going to switch gears right now because the jury reached a verdict today in a chilling case out of Tennessee. Eric Boyd was charged with the brutal deaths of 21-year-old Shannon Christian and 23-year-old Christopher Newsom. Both victims were beaten, raped, and murdered. Newsom was shot three times, then his body doused in gasoline and set on fire. Christian is believed to have been held captive for 24 hours, repeatedly sexually assaulted, then stuffed inside of a trash can to suffocate. Boyd claims he wasn't involved with the vicious murders. Four other co-defendants have already been convicted in the case, with sentences ranging from 35 years in prison to the death penalty. One co-defendant, George Thomas, took the stand against Boyd in exchange for his two life sentences being reduced to 50 years. Now, there were 36 counts in total. So here is the verdict for two of them, the felony murder of Shannon and Christopher. Take a look.
With respect to count one, first-degree felony murder of Hugh Christopher Newsom during the perpetration of robbery of Hugh Christopher Newsom. Did the jury reach a verdict?
Yes, we did.
What is your verdict?
Guilty.
In count three, first-degree felony murder of Shannon Christian during the perpetration of robbery of Hugh Christopher Newsom. Did the jury reach a verdict?
Yes, we did.
What is your verdict?
Guilty.
The jury found Boyd guilty of 36 charges in total, including 18 counts of murder, which the judge merged together for an automatic sentence of life in prison with the possibility of parole. Clearly, the jury sided with the state. And if you recall, in their closing, the prosecution argued that the jury should believe what Boyd's co-defendant George Thomas said and that his claims were backed up by other evidence.
It's been 4,600 days. Since these crimes happened. 4,595 days is how long it's been since George Thomas told Sheriff Hutchison that this defendant marched Chris Newsom into that house on 23. We couldn't use that as long as Mr. Thomas is charged. We can't put Mr. Thomas's statement in against Mr. Boyd until Mr. Thomas gave us permission to do that. And that's why Mr. Thomas is here. Give you a couple more pieces of this puzzle, if you will. He answered questions from Mr. Frazier and from the state without hesitation. And as Sheriff Jones, former Sheriff Jones, told you, he did the same thing 12 years ago when he interviewed. Now, I'm not embracing Mr. Thomas whatsoever. He's a convicted murderer, okay? But I suggest to you, when he testified under oath at the same oath y'all did, that you have the right to believe key elements of his testimony. Did he tell us it? Did he hold back? Sure, he's still holding back. We know that. I'm not going to say he's not. But the key subject matter of his testimony had been corroborated by these other witnesses.
Their turn, the defense argued that the prosecution's case was mere speculation and that Thomas, the state's star witness, was not credible. But based on the verdict today, it appears the jury may not have agreed.
Again, the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that LaMarcus Davidson, Latavius Cobbins, Vanessa Coleman, and George Thomas were responsible for these murders. What about the case against Eric Boyd? And at the end of it, there is no physical evidence that ties Eric Boyd to the rape, to the murder, to the thefts, or to the robberies. The state's case is a lot of speculation. What do we know about Mr. Thomas? Well, we know that he and Latavius Cobbins are best friends. We know that he and Latavius were present during the abductions, rapes, and murders, and that after the crimes were committed, they fled to Kentucky. We know that in Kentucky, they're caught with Shannon's property. When they talk to the police, both implicate Eric Boyd, but neither LaMarcus nor Vanessa Coleman implicate him. And he's loyal to Latavius. He doesn't know Eric Boyd. He doesn't know him. He's loyal, so loyal to him that he doesn't even directly implicate Latavius in the crimes that took place at 2316 Chipman Street. even when he testified the other day. He didn't implicate his best friend.
The family of the victims were pleased with the verdict, and they spoke to the media afterwards. "We got him," said Mary Newsom. This is the mother of Christopher Newsom. And the father of Shannon Christian, Gary Christian, he said, "He was just as much a part of the death of my daughter as any other one." He's referring there to the four other co-defendants who were already convicted. Joining me now, special guests, criminal defense attorneys Linda Kenny-Bodden and Eklan Mercy. Great to have you both. Linda, want to start here with you. So you got to tell me, did the jury make the right decision? Some are calling it shocking.
Well, I tell you, I don't think there was any evidence, and I certainly didn't like George Thomas, but I understand why they did, because the white car puts the defendant, Eric Boyd, there, and with this party to a crime theory and charge and law, could he be responsible under it? Yep, he could be.
Eklan, let me ask you this. Is it possible the jury was swayed just by the brutal nature of the attacks? And again, they shouldn't be swayed by that or emotion, but by the law and the facts. But what do you think?
Absolutely. These are real pictures. So they're looking at autopsy pictures. They're looking at crime scene photos. It's not just, you know, the viewers just see the testimony. They are actually seeing footage. They are actually seeing videos and pictures of the couple in a most where you're not supposed to see people like that.
Right.
So that kind of tattoos that image in their mind, and they feel that they should do something for this family to help them grieve.
Yeah, it was a really horrible case. And Linda, real quick, 20 seconds. Is there anything more the defense could have done?
No, I don't think so, except maybe force a change of venue. And I'm not sure whether there was a motion made and whether that could have been done this late in the study stage.
Well, I got to tell you, there's a lot of people who were surprised by that. But I want you two to stand by because we have a lot more to talk about. So still ahead tonight on The Debrief, a new trial begins with a Florida man accused of murdering his neighbor because he was playing music too loudly. Now, will it be life in prison or the death penalty for Grant Amato, the man convicted of murdering his parents and brother after they cut him off from sending money to a webcam model? We'll bring you the penalty verdict when we come back. Welcome back, everybody. The jury returned with a verdict in the penalty phase of the Grant Amato trial around 8 p.m. last night. They had to decide whether or not Amato, who killed his parents and brother, would spend the rest of his life in prison or be executed. Prosecutors say Amato became obsessed with a Bulgarian cam girl and sent her $200,000 of his parents' money. When his parents intervened and tried to shut down the relationship, prosecutors say Grant Amato murdered both of them and his brother, Cody. Let's listen right now to the jury's decision on his punishment.
Count one, Margaret Amato, jury verdict as to the death penalty. Having unanimously found that the aggravating factor or factors outweigh the mitigating circumstances, section D, we the jury unanimously find that Grant Amato should be sentenced to death. No. Count two, Chad Amato, jury verdict as to death penalty. We the jury unanimously find that Grant Amato should be sentenced to death. No. Count three, Cody Amato, jury verdict as to death penalty. We the jury unanimously find that Grant Amato should be sentenced to death. No. Signed, four person, dated August 12, 2018 in Seminole County, Florida.
Amato displayed no reaction as he found out his life would be spared. His brother Jason Amato, who testified during the trial and penalty phases, he took a deep breath. Then he kissed his girlfriend, who appeared to be on the verge of tears. The jury decided that the aggravating circumstances were actually greater than the mitigating, meaning that the evidence for the death penalty was stronger. But the jury decided, or at least one juror did, that life in prison was the appropriate sentence. Now, Jason, who lost essentially his entire family, his parents and brother are dead and his brother was convicted of killing them, he took the stand to read an emotional victim impact statement.
I cannot give an exact number of how many people have felt the loss of my family, but there were hundreds of people at their funeral. The minister that led the service told me in his 50 years, he has never seen a funeral with three caskets. It has been very hard to devote reflection to either my father, mother, or brother. As I start to think of one, it's hard to not think of the others. There are so many memories, stories, and special times that I will never forget. However, I will never be able to make new ones. The toughest thing in all this is how it continues to affect my girls. especially the girls, or especially the kids. Christina misses the stories and comfort my family gave, particularly my mom, who always made her feel like a daughter. There are certain things Christina adored about my mom. She could light up a room with her smile and go with the flow personality. Our daughters, they're troubled daily. Nightmares, depression, confusion, fear, and having to live lives in the public eye. They miss the days at the barn with my mom, who taught them both how to ride. There are numerous occasions I can think of, but to get to the real question, or how this has affected me, plain and simple, 2019 has been a tragic year.
So as we think about the jury's decision, take a listen to this. Instead of cross-examining Jason Amato, the defense called him as their own witness, where they asked him just one question. Take a look.
Despite everything that's happened and all the loss that you've suffered and everything, do you love your brother, Graham Amato?
Yes.
Okay. I have no other questions.
What a tragic case. Let's move on to a new one. A new trial began today for a Florida man accused of murdering his neighbor in broad daylight. Chufeng Ki, or Joe, as he's referred to, is charged with first-degree murder in connection with the shooting of Edward Tudor. Authorities indicated that the defendant believed he was constantly bullied and harassed by Tudor, ultimately leading him to taking matters into his own hands. In their opening statement, the prosecution laid out the brutal and bizarre series of events that they say led to the defendant murdering the victim.
Mr. Tudor heads over to his bedroom, and as he's coming out of his bedroom, this defendant has let himself into Mr. Tudor's house by the front door. This defendant, armed to the teeth. Mr. Tudor doesn't know what's going on, and this defendant pulls out a firearm, points it at Mr. Tudor and shoots him. Mr. Tudor is standing there holding a dog, gets hit in the arm. Mr. Tudor is asking, what's wrong? What's the matter? What did I do, Joe? And you'll hear this defendant, a nickname that was used for him was Joe, Joseph. Mr. Tudor stumbles out and heads out to the front yard. He exits the house from the front door and is now in his front yard. But this defendant comes back down the stairs and re-engages with Mr. Tudor. The defendant chases Mr. Tudor around the side of the house, chases Mr. Tudor back to the front of the house, where Mr. Tudor gets on his knees. He has his hands up, saying, "Please, Joe, what did I do? What did I do?" This defendant, saying, "You know what you did," moving around him, wants to shoot him in the head, but can't bring himself to shoot him in the face. He tries, shoots him twice in the body, and Mr. Tudor goes down. And then this defendant moves around and shoots him once in the back of the head.
Then the prosecution says Key immediately surrenders to police, tells them where to find the surveillance video, and gives them this reason for killing his neighbor. All right, so I think some of the audio was a little troublesome there, but this is the part that we really wanted to get to, because the prosecution played the surveillance tape literally showing the killing as it happened. You're going to see that right now, but I want to warn you, this is disturbing.
I'm sorry, Ms. Cromer, can you see the individual in the red shirt that's entered the video? If you could just step down and tell us, is that Mr. Key, the defendant who you previously identified?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. You can resume your seat.
So as you can see right here, this is the defendant walking into Tudor's home. Again, he shoots him once in the torso. As you just heard from the prosecutor, he says, "What did I do, Joe?" He stumbles outside. The defendant then goes upstairs. He's looking for Tudor's roommate, Jennifer Nichols. Then he shoots a locked door. No one was there. At this point, he comes out and he shoots the victim once more, execution style, once more in the head, and he goes down. This is so dramatic. This is incredible to watch. The jury saw this today, and whenever you see a case like this, where you have this surveillance footage, it's pretty alarming. So, of course, you're wondering, why was this case why wasn't there a guilty plea? Well, the defendant did request the plea deal, but the defendant, he didn't ask for life in prison. No, he wanted the death penalty. In fact, he wrote this to the judge. I plead no contest to the first-degree premeditated murder with a death sentence. I used 9mm with the intent to kill, not just wound. Death sentence is a win-win for every side involved in this case. All right, back with us once again is Linda Kenny Bodden and Eklund Mercy. So, Eklund, Linda, let me start with you. As you look at this, my question is, what can the defense do? Because they haven't done anything as of yet. Where do they go in this case?
They have to give their opening statement at the end of the prosecution case saying, we're not refuting anything. We're going to show you that this man has a family and his history of psychiatric problems, and therefore you should spare his life even if he doesn't want it spared.
Eklund, my question to you is, at the bare minimum, what does the defense have to do? Even if their client says, I don't want you doing anything, I want you to walk me straight to that guilty chamber, the guilty plea, I don't even care. What's the bare minimum they have to do?
You still have to be competent and zealous in your representation, despite your client. You still have to represent him because you can make bad law by just doing a terrible job. You still have to represent him. You still have to give competent and zealous representation. He still has a defense. Although it may not be a successful defense, he still has one.
It's going to be an uphill defense. And Linda, I guess right. The question, of course, is you have a defendant like this, you have a case like this. Is this something common that you see where you have this dispute with neighbors? I've known we've covered a lot of these cases here, but is this something you see before, this kind of feuds brewing and it ultimately leads to murder?
Not that ends, as Eklund would say, in a snuff film, Jesse. I mean, usually what happens is you go to a municipal court and you work it out, there's some complaints, but this is everyone's nightmare that somebody that lives next to you, it's like a horror film. They come in, they break it, they get into your house, they don't even tell you they're there, they shoot you while you're holding your dog, which is a little fact I missed today. You run out, you plead for your life, and then you get shot, and killed, and destroys everybody. I've never seen anything quite like this.
And when you look at this case and you research it, he appeared to be pretty proud of what he did and felt justified for what he did. But we are in the beginning stages of this case. It's a lot more to cover. And I just want to thank our guests, Linda Kenny Bodden and Eklund Mercy, to come on and break down all of these really bizarre but yet tragic cases. So thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us tonight. Our live trial coverage resumes tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Long Prime Network. The Debrief is on tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Have a great night.